magnitude of that phase center above the mount and the polarization. Make some more sense, Dave. KB.
Another question that I would have also is, when you would put these ferrite rods end to end to end,
I think you're asking what happens when you put the ferrite rods end to end. You could do that if you wanted to. And now you have a larger amount of ferrite. In other words, your overall, what's it now called, neutral impedance is not the right word I'm looking for. Permeability. Your overall permeability goes up a little bit. The amount of saturation it can tolerate goes up. So you come out ahead when you do that. Putting the rods end to end, or putting the rods side by side, wrapping the wire around the whole group of them. In either case, you now can tolerate a stronger amount of magnetic field before you hit saturation, so there's some advantage in doing that. The more ferrite you use, and to get the same resonance, less turns are required, the stronger magnetic field it can tolerate before it saturates. So when you're transmitting through ferrite, you have to concern yourself at all times with whether or not you're saturating the iron. So maybe that's sort of the question you're asking there, Dave. KBQMAR, hope you can ride over this jazz. If not, I'll listen to you on the input. K2RIW on the deck net. Are listening on the input and reporting at that website, rfi@smartlifear.org. Write down what signal strength you hear, what time you're hearing it, and particularly if it's the weaker signal, we have to listen in the sideband mode. Let us know about that too. So, as you can tell, we need your help to pin down the situation. It's been going on for 3 years. It's getting a little bit annoying.
Repeater, timeout. Repeater, timeout.
KB2MAR, K2RIW. Dave, and then give me an answer. K2RIW.
I definitely gotta try this ferrite type of antenna. Sounding really good to me. I mean, you could put more side by side. I wonder what's the maximum you can put without running into trouble. Or maybe there is no maximum, except that the more you probably put end to end.
Spectrum analyzer would be the Cadillac approach, but it doesn't have to be a spectrum analyzer. You could do it with a receiver listening for the second harmonic or the third harmonic. When the ferrite saturates, you'll get a very distinct, drastic increase in the second and third harmonic being radiated by the antenna. So by doing a test where the receiver is tuned to the second or third harmonic, as you slowly sneak up on the power, you'll find the point where it's starting to saturate, and you know you've got to back off from there. So that could be a very interesting set of experiments, Gabe. And once you finish with those experiments, it's time that somebody go write an article and give the rest of the world that information. Don't keep that left.
KC2QIQ, the comment.
Go ahead, Glenn. KC2QIQ. What's your favorite way of measuring? Favorite way of measuring saturation, Glenn. Go ahead, Glenn. KQLAW.
Yeah, the term saturation with ferrites and magnetic materials really makes a lot of sense when you're talking about DC and frequencies, certainly well under 1 megahertz, hundreds of kilohertz. Then you really talk about saturation and having the peak flux intensity hit, and then the inductance collapses. The mu actually goes from a peak level of some high number down to, you know, something very close to one. In the case of RF and radio frequencies and using ferrite materials, you'll never hit saturation. It'll never happen. Basically what'll happen is it'll get hot. And basically what'll happen is you'll melt everything on the outside. The best insulation grade you can probably get in wire is somewhere around 200 degrees C. And typically the wire will start to melt long before, and you'll hit the Curie point, the temperatures, which are extremely high, long before you'll ever get to saturation, Vic. K2IW, KC2QIQ.
Yeah, but when the nonlinearity you're describing takes place, by which heating takes place at RF frequencies, that is a kind of saturation. It's treating the peak of the RF cycle different than the crossover of the RF cycle. When it comes to ferrite, when it comes to iron-like materials, you take, for instance, a YIG filter, YIG, stands for yttrium iron garnet. And if you use a YIG filter in the vicinity of 1.8 gigahertz, the low end of its operating frequency range, and you hit it with more than around plus 20 dBm of power, I've done this, it goes into a kind of oscillation of its own that's not necessarily on the operating frequency, and it's definitely a nonlinear material, and it does make other harmonics. So ferrite and iron and ferromagnetic materials, when you go above a certain power level, have a number of mechanisms of nonlinearity. If it's capable of making heat, it's capable of making other frequencies that I think can be detected, Glenn. KC2QIQ, K2LIW.
Yeah, that's actually another interesting feature using magnetic materials at RF frequencies, at radio frequencies, that at some frequencies the ferrite will absorb and look small, which is really generally the case of most RF frequencies, but there are some other properties where you can get actually some impedances that will interreact with the wire, and you can get sub-resonance. Depending on how broad a bandwidth and what part of how your wire is mounted around the core. So, yes, you have to be careful of resonances as well. But that's really not saturation, Dick, yeah. But you can definitely hit frequencies within the bandwidth of how you construct the wire build around the ferrite where, yes, you could create an oscillation for sure, but not necessarily saturation. Back to you, Dick. K2RW, KC2QIQ.
Glenn, you've spent a good fraction of your life working on magnetic materials at reasonably high power levels for the square wave and non-square wave inverters that you've worked on, and power conditioners and things like this. I want you to speculate a little bit for us. If you were trying to design a ferrite-like antenna for the purpose of making it small and compact and portable for ham radio operation on any ham radio frequency, if you had decided to do something like that, and I can tell Gabe is on the threshold of doing that, where do you think the minefield is? What would you look out for? What special considerations do you think are required to build a ferrite-like transmitting antenna, maybe for only QRP, but maybe even for beyond, but to be compact and portable? What would you worry about? What would you be looking out for if you were doing that, Glenn? KC2QIQ, K2LIW, the tech man.
Well, I know it's very good for coupling mechanisms, high-Q coupling, basically because the losses are very, very low in high-Q coupling. So in other words, if you have two loops, a short loop, which is your tuning or your impedance loop, coupled like a balun type of circuit or an isolation circuit, you can create some very, very nice antenna projects with that. I'm not sure I'm following you when you're saying you want to use ferrite as the antenna. Give me a couple more words, Dick.
Okay, Glenn, you and I have many times in our life used a pocket transistor radio, which has a ferrite loop antenna that does the receiving. The fact that it does receiving, and the fact that most antennas, not all, obey the law of reciprocity. If it's a quasi-efficient receiving antenna, in theory, on the exact same frequency, it can transmit. Now, maybe that ferrite loop antenna in our transistor radio is only capable of transmitting 10 or 100 milliwatts. Maybe it's only a QRP antenna. But the fact that those QRP, the fact that those ferrite loop antennas were down at 1 megacycle doesn't mean it can't be used at 3.5 megacycles and 7.0 megacycles. So to transmit with ferrite loop antennas in order to be compact, portable for a field operation, if you had decided to do that and believing that most of the time a receiving antenna obeys reciprocity and you can transmit through it, I know that every one of these transmitting antennas with a ferrite rod has a specific power level beyond which, for a bunch of reasons, you shouldn't go. So if you were designing such a thing, what would you look out for, Glenn? KCQQIQ, K2LIW, and the tech man?
It probably wouldn't be my approach, Dick. The first thing that I would be very concerned about is, one, ferrite's pretty delicate and expensive material. And in order to get cross-sectional areas large enough and lengths long enough to create a transmitting power loopstick antenna, I think you'd wind up with something that's very heavy, very bulky, and very expensive. So I think that's probably why you don't see them. But is it possible? Sure. Why not? But, you'd be talking about hunks of ferrite. In what band? What frequency? Maybe in VHF it's possible, but there again, I'm not sure that, you know, it's going to beat a whip, a 17-inch whip or 18-inch whip in a ground plane. I'm not sure. Is there some sweet spot that somebody's thinking about?
Both the Radio Society of Great Britain and the American Radio Relay League are proposing to their FCC an equivalent ham band at 100 KC, 500 KC, down at super low frequencies, where for the time being we have a narrow frequency assignment at a low power level, like 1 watt or 0.1 watt, and so using ferrite-like antennas down at those super low frequencies could save you a whole lot of real estate as to the antenna dimensions and to and the size of the construction. So being able to transmit at some particular quasi-ham frequency, I think, is possible. I don't think we should reject the idea. And yes, some of the super high-quality ferrites from the good manufacturers are at Cadillac prices. Every so often, though, hams will run into a discarded surplus product, which is very cheap on the surplus market, and you can get a whole lot of ferrite in your hands, and maybe they start off as toroids, and you slice the toroids in half and use these as squiggly pieces, if you know what I mean. But hams are pretty crafty. I think there's ways of doing it, and it's an area that, because of our lack of familiarity, we haven't gone there to date, but I don't think we should reject that area. Back to you, Glenn, K2RAW in the TechNet.
Okay, now I'm on the right page. Okay, what's going on here is, back to remember what I said, that how the magnetic materials make very good coupling devices. In other words, one of the advantages to using a magnetic loop antenna, now I understand what you're referring to, is that you have basically two loops. You can create a small loop and then basically have a turns ratio increase, in other words, between the secondary loop, which is going to be your transmitting antenna, and the primary loop that's going to couple back to your radio. It's got a really nice advantage to doing this. The bad part is it's very narrow. It's high Q, and you have to constantly retune the loop for small viral variations. But if you're in a very, very narrow frequency band, certainly it's a very good way to go. Because if you just want to operate on one frequency, like if you have one really popular frequency and you don't really want to make a huge HF antenna, you can kind of take a relatively short loop of wire and basically create an antenna match just by coupling the turns ratio in a piece of ferrite. I think we've had this discussion on earlier TechNets where I'd mentioned I'd made these kinds of like voltage-fed balance that where you can actually tune them.
2 meter transmit.
An antenna. So, actually small loops, in other words, they're not very large in diameter at all, and they work very well, and you can run them, with moderate size ferrite, kilowatt of power, easy. KC2QIQ.
That little loop stick ferrite thing that's in my transistorized radio does tune with that 365 picofarad variable capacitor from 0.5 megacycles to 1.5 megacycles across the whole AM broadcast band. That's a 3-to-1 frequency ratio. So I'll admit that little ferrite loop is not going to take very many watts in a transmit function, but there it doesn't appear to have high Q in that application, Glenn, because it is able to tune over that 3-to-1 frequency region. So properly chosen ferrite, properly used, I think can be reasonably broadband. I'm worried about how much power I can put into it, and you're worried about the cost, but I think there are ways of getting around all this. Back to you for comments on that, Glenn. K2RIW in the TechNet.
HWW with a comment.
How we recognize. Yeah, what's happening with the loop stick antenna in an AM radio is not something you're going to transmit with. And is it a high Q antenna? Yeah, it sure is. Now, let me explain this one. I had a recent question because it wasn't intuitive. I had a Grundig broadband receiver here that had marvelous receive sensitivity over very, very broad bands. And I was using that radio with very moderate antennas. And I was looking into what makes this receiver so hot with such short antennas. And I went into it and I found exactly what you were saying was a ferrite type of antenna that, and basically what they were doing was they had a capacitor network inside there that was not easy to figure out how they were doing mechanically how they were doing it, but basically as the dial got tuned, what they were basically doing was retuning the capacitor along with it. And how they do it in the Grundig is very interesting, is that they have a digital converter and the D-to-A back again, where when you're tuning the dial, what it actually does is it has preset points where it's actually pre-tuning varactor capacitance on that coil, and it actually tunes it broadband. In AM radios, they did it basically by adjusting the impedance of transistors back to the tuning dial, so that they were actually kind of like using at very, very low frequencies, like for AM radio, where they were actually doing like a high Q pre-tuning, and they were also using that ganged as the main tuning in a kind of a superette situation. But in all those cases of those receiving loop stick, definitely a high Q circuit. KC2QIQ.
Yeah, I did see evidence of it being high in Q, obvious by the fact that when you're doing the tracking arrangement, the tracking alignment of a transistor AM radio, where you're adjusting whether or not the local oscillator and the RF amplifier are tracking each other as you tune across the dial. I had the impression that any one instant of time, the loop stick receiving antenna on that AM transistor radio is about 20 kilohertz wide, and each one of the channels of AM broadcast are around 10 kilohertz wide, so it is compatible. And as long as you've got the right tracking control, the 365 picofarad air variable capacitor, it works. And if it works that well as a receiver, potentially, because of the law of reciprocity, at least at low powers, I say, at that frequency range, it's got to work as a transmitter. So I think there is a possibility here. How Howie, I wonder if you've got some experience with satellite loops in the transmitting mode and or the receiving mode. WB2HWW, C2RIW in the TechNet. Go ahead, Howie.
Experience, okay. Very briefly, yeah, with the AM broadcast systems, those antennas basically are used to also, you know, they're only 20 kc wide, but they also give you selectivity. That's how you get selectivity in an AM broadcast radio, so you don't get overloaded, let's say, from CBS 880, and you're listening to, let's say, WABC at WR at 710, you know. Okay, the comment that I wanted to make on this Alex antenna, if you look at it, it's two loops. It looks like a transformer. It looks like it's made out of hardware. It's actually made out of copper. And basically, the primary is your tuning and your secondary. They have a size ratio. That's how they're... And they say that it has a, you know... WB2HWW. You look at the antenna, it looks like a transformer, Dick.
Yeah, I've gone to the website, I'm looking at it right now, and I recognize that that's the... I see the very small loop at the top, the large loop behind it, so to speak. And if you remember the Saturn 6 meter antenna, which was very popular in the late 50s, early 60s, certain versions of it. The main radiator had 3, 4, or 5 loops to it. The feeding arrangement was a small loop inside, a little bit like a gamma match rod. And so to do impedance matching, the feed mechanism versus the main radiator, many of the loop antennas use that phenomenon. And so that's a fairly popular technique. It's not a brand new breakthrough. Are they claiming that there's some kind of a breakthrough? Howie, back to you, Howie, K2LAW in the TechNet.
I'm not claiming it, just saying that this is a great antenna. I haven't read all the advertising, I was just asked about it, and this is a very interesting antenna in AM broadcast. Timeout, Dick?
Not sure if it was a timeout or not, but during the period of time when the machine was not repeating what Howie was saying, he was saying that the Sony 2010 and the Grundig are really good radios that use similar techniques, but you got to be careful with the Sony 2010. The way you ground it, you can create a electrostatic discharge and damage the front end of that. I think that's approximately what you were saying. Is that true, Howie? So V2HWW, K2LIW.
Yeah, but I'm also saying if you hook a long wire to it, if you hook an outside antenna to it, you could lose the front end.
So Howie was saying the 2010, you got to be careful when you're putting a long wire on the electrostatic discharge. It's no longer manufactured, but it was a real good radio, and he likes it. Obviously, he's got a copy of one of those. I think that's the main thing you were saying, Howie. Let's see if I can get a reset. Stand by, and then I'll pass it over to you. Okay, go ahead before we time out and repeat anything you want to, Howie. HWW, K2LIW.
Well, nothing other than just, you know, we're making it on the 2010. Now, one of the guys here, by the way, a couple of the guys on my repeater are going to go to a solar activation, and they're looking at small antennas to carry it. Weight is most important. They're going to be taking the Heli X3, the new radio, and the ASU 817. So they're going to be running through a couple of watts. It looks like QRP is it's the up-and-coming thing now, Dick. A lot of guys are getting into QRP. But the only other comment is that the 2010 and the Grundig's a good radio. The Sony 2010 has upper and lower sideband, and it has synchronous detection. So when you listen to an AM signal, you don't get the phase distortion. Go ahead, Dick.
Okay, every bit of that came through beautifully. And you're putting out a lot of steam, Howie. I'll be hearing you 50 over 9 on the input. Well done. Okay, that sounds like a great radio. Tunes in 10 or 20 kc's, 10 or 20 hertz steps in the sideband mode, synchronous demodulation, which I think in theory means that it is separately demodulating the upper sideband and the lower sideband of an AM broadcast. And yes, I can give you a hell of a lot less fades. An awful lot of the fades are really selective frequency nulling because of the multipass. In other words, the HF signal is getting to you by way of more than one bounce off that ionosphere, and sometimes those bounces will give you cancellations at certain frequencies. And if it happens to cancel the carrier and the upper and lower sideband are left, you get a Donald Duck sound, a very characteristic sound, and a good synchronous demodulator, or even a sideband demodulator on AM can get around that, does a very good job.
That would be right on frequency with your era heterodyne. Doing that, you have to zero beat. If you don't zero beat it, if you don't zero beat the AM signal, you'll hear a heterodyne. So I think they're doing it some way where they're actually introducing a product detector, actually putting a carrier on it, because if you're not dead on, you will hear a heterodyne. When you're in the AM synchronous detection, you must be zero beat it to the frequency.
Absolutely right. When you're doing a carrier reinsertion, and you're listening to upper and lower sidebands simultaneously, those two sidebands will beat against you and give you a tone if the carrier you're inserting is not exactly the right frequency and the right phase. So I think there are ways that a really good receiver could be using a phase lock loop detector to detect the, even though the carrier is partially nulled, that they can detect enough of the original carrier.
They are using phase lock loop. That's what they're doing, Dick.
Okay, so they are using phase lock. That's the right way to do it. Phase lock loop detection, synchronous demodulation, that kind of a receiver, a Cadillac approach, can really give you a lot better anti-fade characteristics when you're listening to a shortwave broadcast. So when it comes to really good receivers with really good noise blankers and really good demodulator circuits, just a simple envelope detector is kind of primitive, if you know what I mean. I think it's time we go over to the mailbag. And John, what kind of exciting questions that we have this week. KC2WGB. K2IW in the tech net. I'm going to try to get you a reset. Stand by. There we go. Go ahead, John.
Am I getting over that tick?
Yes, you are. Please proceed.
Okay. KC2WGB. Gene, Dick, everybody on the net. We got a nice complimentary letter for you anyway. The Mel's Green Wire antenna, another subject. A gentleman has what he called a branchless tree, which is a laundry pole in his backyard, 35 feet high. He did. He followed your... But he used the old 300-ohm antenna wire standoff screw-in mount. And what he did was he threaded those into the wooden pole, which is 35 feet high, and he ran his wire through those, crimped them up, and he ran over the top and down a little bit. I don't know the exact length, but he's using it for 40 and 20, and it works like a charm. He has it hooked up to his tuner, and it's working well. So he appreciates the conversations that you had about that antenna, and he really got into this. Now he has a question. Now we've covered this subject with horizontal dipoles, but is this, he's asking, how far should he space them? And when he's using the antennas he's not going to be using, should he terminate them? He wants to add two more antennas to this pole. I know one is going to be 15 meters. I think the other one is going to be probably 17, somewhere around there. But, so two more antennas. He'll have three wires total. And what he did was he ran three runs of coax, the RG8U down to the bottom with a ground rod, and he simply just connected the shield to the ground rod, and all of this goes back to an antenna tuner. And he's just worried about the spacing of the additional wires. Maybe you can give some info on that. KC2WGB, back to you, Dick.
Yeah, though he's got a vertical wooden pole, I'm guessing it's a wooden pole, with these wires looped over the top, and he's making the wire in the vicinity of a half wavelength of electrical length, and he's feeding hitting one end, and he probably has to step up the impedance when he does that to a higher impedance than the normal 50 or 70 ohms, so to speak. It's a little bit similar to a fan dipole. In the case of a fan dipole, where you might have 80, 40, 20, and 15 meter dipoles all coming together at a common center point, and they flare out. And the only reason you flare them out is because the higher frequency, shorter dipoles will have some capacitive coupling from their end to the adjacent lower frequency dipole. Therefore, it creates a little bit of detuning. And as you make the flare angle greater, the amount of detuning decreases. And even if you haven't got very much real estate to give you a significant flare angle, as long as you're willing to readjust the length, the problem goes away. So by taking each of your antennas, putting them on the wooden pole in any physical arrangement you like, and then taking each individual antenna, let me drop. You take the physical length that you've got, and now on each one of your dipoles, start off on the lowest frequency one first, sweep it across the band, like if it's an 80-meter dipole, you'll make a measurement of 3.5, 3.6, 3.7 megacycles and so on across the band, and plot those as a horizontal graph. And if everything is great as far as the length is concerned, you'll get a bathtub-shaped curve, a U-shaped curve, where the bottom of the U will be some reasonable standing wave ratio, like 1.5 to 1, and hopefully the bottom of that bathtub... Hopefully the bottom of the bathtub falls in the center of the band that you care about. Then you go to the next higher band. Well, because of your close physical spacing in his arrangement, similar to having a fan dipole where the fan is very gradual fanning, where the ends are pretty close together, as you go up to the higher frequency antennas, you'll discover that they are tuned a little bit too low in frequency because of capacitive end coupling. And as long as you're willing to readjust the length of that antenna to bring it up to the right frequency, the problem goes away. The fact that you're getting cross-coupling between them in this manner is not a bad situation. It doesn't waste power, if you know what I mean. The wire itself is a lossless phenomenon. Those stand-up insulators and the pole are lossless. Again, any antenna that you're suspicious of, put whatever power you've got into it, run a key down for a couple of minutes, turn off the transmitter, run over there, and touch everything with your hand. If all the physical components of the antenna are cold, and as long as you've done a good enough impedance match so that the standing wave ratio to your transmission line is a reasonably low number, you're not getting a whole lot of reflected power, then by definition, it is efficient, it's radiating, and you've got it made. And the advantage of the actual physical antenna being close to a half wavelength in electrical length, in other words, physically you've made it a length such that electronically it acts like a half wavelength antenna being fed from one end, where yes, the impedance will be high and you need some kind of a step-up devices most of the time. But the fact that it's near half wavelength and you're feeding it at one end means that a simple ground rod, in many cases, is more than sufficient for the counterpoise, the ground plane. And the zillions of ground plane radios, in many cases, are no longer required. That's the great advantage of a half-wave physical, a half-wave electronic antenna that does the radiating.
Repeater, timeout. Repeater, timeout.
So it may require some experimentation. And the only bands you've got to worry about is the higher bands, the tips of that dipole, seeing the adjacent, dipole, radiator, the tips of that higher frequency radiator, seeing the capacitive coupling to the other radiator. In fact, since you know that the most vulnerable part of the higher frequency dipoles is the tip capacitance, there's probably ways when you can take the last few feet of the radiator, the furthest away from the transmission line, and by various techniques, tipping it away from the pole or tipping it away from those adjacent antennas to minimize this effect. There's various ways you can tune it. But if that swept curve, the bathtub curve of visoir versus frequency, allows you to see the best visoir at the center of each of those bands, and you do physical adjustment of length to make that happen, you've got it made. And when it comes to the efficiency, your hand and the heat of the antenna will tell you immediately what efficiency you're getting. Over to you, John, KC2WGB, K2RIW in the TechNet.
Okay, Dave, very good. Good information. Now, he is able to get a pretty good visual with the situation he has right now with a single wire. Now, he's running two more coaxial feeds out. It's not going to be a fan dipole. Each one of these wires are going to have its own coax going to it, and they'll be switchable from inside the shack. His question is, does he have to terminate the other two in any fashion, or can he just leave them disconnected via the switch, and will that interfere, or will that absorb any energy? That was another one of the questions.
No. Terminating the unused antennas is almost undesirable, because if energy is coupled into the adjacent antennas, and if they're terminated with, let's say, a 50-ohm resistor, then you could be wasting some of your power pouring it into that resistor. You could experiment with the unused antennas, putting them into either an open circuit or a short circuit. That's a worthwhile experiment. There's also the possibility that one, just like you make a fan dipole with one transmitter, one transmission line going to the center of all of those fan dipoles, there is the possibility in this antenna where one single transmitter line goes out to the individual impedance matching networks, an inductor and a capacitor, that goes to the individual antennas, and you feed them all at once. The nice thing about a fan dipole is that only the desired dipole is resonant at the frequency you're now feeding, and all the others are very non-resonant. In other words, when I'm feeding 40 meters into a fan dipole, the 40-meter dipole is the one that has the right impedance. He's absorbing 97% of the power and radiating into space. The 80-meter dipole and the 20-meter dipole are both so extremely high in standing wave ratio that they absorb none of the power, even though you're feeding power to them. They're not absorbing it. So the possibility exists that one transmitting line with the right impedance matching devices at the end can feed every one of these antennas simultaneously. And even if some of the power goes into the wrong radiator, that's not bad, because as long as it's being radiated to space, you don't care which one of the wires radiates it. Even if all of them radiated it, that's a good sign. So terminating with a resistor, I say no. Terminating with a shorter and open circuit makes an interesting experiment, but you might not have...
Repeater, timeout.
Whether or not the unused ones get terminated with a short or an open would be an interesting experiment, but you might not have to do it. So I see a lot of capability for this antenna, and once he perfects these individual details that we're talking about, I think it's time an article be written on this one, John. KC2WGB, K2RIW.
KC2WGB. Very interesting, Dave. Yes, I agree. I think what he should do is he has that buried cable. Use that. Put two more wires up there, whatever length he's going to use, and match them up and see how that works before he runs. And you're right. If one of the other antennas is absorbing some of the power, it's going to be radiating if it's not turning into heat. So, I see no problem with that. That's going to be very interesting. I hope he does get back to me if this works out. So, let me drop. We'll go on to the next one.
Yeah, I think he's got a very interesting antenna there, John. And once he perfects the individual details, that's definitely worthy of an article. You got it, John.
Yes, Dick, and with his tuner, he's able to get a pretty good SWR match on the existing one. And I don't know what type of matching network he's using with it, but he may be using nothing, just the tuner. But evidently, that's working for him. Okay, let me pick up, I'll drop it, and we'll go on to, I have two questions on RFID tags.
And by the way, as long as his transmission line is low enough in insertion loss at his operating frequencies, he has the ability to do all of that tuning with a good wideband antenna tuner in the shack. He has that ability. And as I said, I think he's onto something real good there, John. Go ahead with your RFID questions, K2LIW on the TechNet.
Okay, two gentlemen with similar questions. The gentleman heard a conversation about RFID tags and how you describe a warehouse and being able to pick out where something is buried behind. Now, his question is, could an RFID tag be put on something and use that for a targeting device? That's an interesting question, Dick. The range of detection possible. What do you think of that? Over to you, Dick.
Yes,
Dick.
Are sophisticated versions of an RFID reader where as you wave the antenna on the reader, the antenna itself can have high directivity. One of the ones that I worked on had a three-element Yagi on the front end of the handheld reader, and so it has approximately 80-degree beamwidth. In other words, if you could see the signal coming out of the front of this reader, it would be a great big fat cucumber in space. You could wave that back and forth and aim it in the direction where you get the strongest signal. And the more sophisticated readers, have the ability to give you range to the target. So if you can wave the thing back and forth and know that the target that you're looking for, let's assume that it's a box of perishable material in a warehouse, and the box happens to be the second box back on the shelf where you can't even see the box. Therefore, you would not be able to read a barcode. But by way of RFID that penetrates the cardboard box in front, you wave this thing back and forth and you find out that the strongest signal is 30 degrees away from north, and that you wave it up and down and you find out it's 30 degrees up in the air, and you find out that the tag is 20 feet in front of you, and the reader is giving you that information. It tells you exactly where to go, and you've got that box in your hand in a very short period of time. And this perishable material that was put in the wrong place in that warehouse, you have just found it, and you have saved your employer a whole lot of money. He's going to give you a raise. You're going to get a chance to get more vacation. You're going to go to Hawaii. You can see all these good things that can happen. Now, let me drop. Your next question is, can you put RFID tags on moving targets, like a cow, a dog, a cat? The answer is absolutely yes. I didn't say it's easy. Because whenever you put an RFID tag on absorptive materials, an absorptive material is a bottle of soda or is the protoplasm of the neck of an animal, you've got to go through a couple of slightly more elaborate kind of an RFID tag that can tolerate lossy materials nearby and still give you high performance. But could you put the RFID tag on the television control unit that keeps getting lost in the house and you want to find it? You can put it on the cat that keeps getting lost, the dog that keeps getting lost, your pet rabbit that gets lost. You can put RFID tags on human beings, on all kinds of things. And with the right kind of a reader, you will find that object in your house, in your warehouse, in your backyard, in your woods, or whatever. A really good, thoroughly passive RFID tag can be read up to a distance of almost 40 feet. And I'm not kidding. Some of the really good tags and the really good readers will read that tag at 40 feet. And at 40 feet, that thing is talking back to you, and it has no battery. And in theory, it will keep operating for the next 30 years, if you know what I mean. I wonder if that gives you some ideas, John. KC2WGV, K2LIW.
KC2WGV. Interesting answers, Dick. I have no idea why he's asking that, but yeah. I guess he has an application. Okay, another RFID tag question from a different gentleman, something which I was involved in. He would like to know if it would be possible to put a RFID tag on something like a steel beam or maybe a lump of granite.
Repeater, timeout. Repeater, timeout. Cancel.
Of that question, John, when you said, putting the RFID tag on a steel beam or a piece of granite. I think there's a little bit more to it. So why don't you give us the rest of that question? Over to you, John.
Okay, the rest of the question was placing the RFID tag on either granite or a piece of steel beam, and having maybe a resistance balance network, a strain gauge on it, would that be able to work, and could they read information from a strain gauge coupled through the RFID tag information?
Give that man a cigar. That is the next embodiment you're going to see when it comes to breakthrough procedures for using RFID tags. Can the RFID tag become a thoroughly passive remote telemetering device? Answer is absolutely yes. It's not a popular idea yet. You can't go to five manufacturers and find that. But you, as a smart electronic engineer, can you hook up any kind of a sensing device? I don't care if it's signal strength, current, magnetic field, temperature, strain gauge, deflection, or whatever. Can you have a remote sensing device connected to the little integrated circuit chip that's on the RFID tag, and therefore, when you interrogate that tag, not only does it tell you it's tag number 5,421 with 96 bits of information, it also, with those 96 bits, can tell you when the measurement was made, how many volts, how much current it measured, when it made the measurement. A whole history can be fed back to you by that tag doing those measurements. One of the things I gave as an example last week was that this little $1 tag, so to speak, could be hanging 150, 200 feet in the air. It is sitting on one of those wires of a 300 kilovolt transmission line. It's measuring the local current on that line by measuring the local magnetic field. And now you walk along with your handheld reader, aim it up at that transmission line, read that tag. The tag reads back to you, I'm tag number so-and-so, and right now I'm reading 1,251 amperes. And an hour ago, I measured half of that current. Can that tag give you that information thoroughly, passively, for the next X number of years? The answer is yes. It's just a matter of somebody saying, I need that, go and do it. The technology is there. Some people have already done those kind of experiments. The tag you're wearing in your hospital can be reading your temperature, your heart rate, and whatever. And as you walk around the hospital, the various interrogators in the various halls of the hospital are reading that information, and so therefore they're getting running records of you, your body, and how it's behaving as you walk down the hall of that hospital. KC2WGB, getting some ideas? K2RIW in the TechNet.
KC2WGB. Great information, Dick. As you know, I did a lot of work with strain gauges, and you've seen them, and you know how complicated, between cementing them onto the steel, which you would have to do with the RFID tag also, and then having the wiring going to all of these balanced bridges is really cumbersome. And when you're dealing with weather problems and you're up high, it's miserable. So I think that would be a great idea, and it's nice. And I figured with 96 bits of information available from these RFID tags that it should be a system that could be developed. But I don't know. Maybe you could go into a little bit of how they would do that, Dick. Is that possible?
Yeah, the current 25-cent tags, the majority of them, the 902 to 928 megacycle region, the so-called 915 megacycle license-free systems and tags, spit out, most of them, 96 bits. There are special versions that that spit out multiples of 96 bits, 96 bits of memory number one, 96 bits of memory number two, and you tell it now to flip from memory number one to memory number two and give me that information. So that already exists. When it comes to mounting the RFID tag against a sheet of metal, the RFID tag really is a printed circuit antenna that's about 4 inches long, and you slap it directly against a sheet of metal. You're going to detune the living daylights out of that dipole. They make a specialized version of the tag where there is a foam backing on the tag which spaces the tag away from the steel by about a quarter of an inch or so. Once there is a foam backing with a tag that's made for that steel, and it automatically spaces it from the steel the right distance as you glue it down, it's a steel and stick type of tag. That will work directly against metal and give you high performance. Let me drop. So you don't just take any old tag and slap it against steel. But as long as you're willing to put in the right kind of a spacer and have the tag properly tuned, operating against metal is relatively easy. I'll admit that if you sunk it into the well of an H-beam and you want to read it from the other side of the H-beam, where the H-beam is acting like a shield, that could be troublesome. But you know ahead of time where you put the tag, you know where you must stand in order to read it. Now, the tags you buy today, is there an input connector on the tag where you connect your external sensing device that's sensing strain or voltage or current or temperature or whatever? No. The tags you buy today do not have that connector built into them. But it's just a matter of you being smart enough as a manufacturer of RFID systems to request that of your tag manufacturer. Let me drop. It's a relatively simple thing for him to add that for you. Now, I'm not saying that all of the degree of difficulty you've got of properly mounting the strain gauge, properly weatherproofing it, and putting the right kind of a preamplifier on it and whatever to take those microvolt signals out of it and properly send it to the tag. You still have the strain gauge interface problem with the environment of the piece of steel that you're trying to measure the strain of. That problem didn't go away. But when it comes to the remote telemetry of that signal, in the case of running a couple of fine wires down from that 300 kilovolt line that's 150 feet in the air, to try to run down those sensing wires to the ground is a real pain. In the case of the RFID tag, you don't have to do that. It's sitting up there making the measurement for you, and it's telemetering that information back to you over the RF link. So that tag has the capability of storing and remembering all kinds of information, and when you interrogate the tag, it can feed that information back to you. And it could literally be a history of current versus time, voltage versus time, strain gauge versus time. All of that is possible. I didn't say it's on the shelf right now. We're talking about a special item, specialty item. But the technology is there to do it. We're not breaking any laws of physics, if you know what I mean. KC2WGB, K2LIW in the TechNet.
KC2WGB. Oh, very fine, Dick. Yeah, I would imagine the substrate, which would have to go between the steel and the tag, would have to be a rigid type, because that really gets cemented pretty firmly to the steel. Yeah, and that is exactly what I mean. It's labor-intensive. That would simplify and make a big difference in what it costs to do strain gauge analysis, which is really a pain. Nobody really likes doing it. But, oh, great information, and I'm very interested in that. So that's in the pipe, possibly, and I know it has applications. I assume they could do the same thing wherever stress is, whether it be on a bridge or the stone structure, things like that. Very interesting. I got one more quick one. Let me let it drop. We'll move on to the next.
Water molecules are moving 640 meters per second is their speed. And the sound through water is quite a bit faster. But the frequency that you see, as long as you have a non-moving transmitter and a non-moving receiver, so you're not experiencing a Doppler shift, then whatever frequency you launch is the exact frequency you receive. There's no shift in frequency. You may have a shift in amplitude versus frequency. In other words, if you're transmitting a tone of 50 hertz, 500 hertz, and 5 kc, three separate tones of equal amplitude at the transmitter, I'll admit that the 1,000 meters away, the individual amplitudes you're going to get, one of them may be stronger than the other. In other words, the water characteristics will favor certain frequencies. So the amplitude of the individual tones will go up and down as a function of range and salinity and angles and whatever. But the 500 hertz tone will stay exactly 500 hertz and so on. The 5 kc tone will stay exactly 5 kc as long as there's no Doppler. But if now the emitting device is on a moving boat and the receiving device is on a moving boat, yes, you're going to get Doppler shift. But there's no way that a passive medium can change the frequency that you put into it. If it's an exotic, let me drop. If it's an exotic square wave and you do a Fourier series, Fourier transform, a Fourier analysis of your square wave, which in general has a whole lot of odd harmonics, in other words, the fundamental frequency, the third, the fifth, and the seventh, you put them together just right and you come up with a square wave. Because the individual frequency components going through the water will be changed in amplitude, what you get out of the other end is not going to be a clear square wave anymore, because individual frequency components have been shifted a little bit in amplitude or phase. Not frequency, amplitude or phase. So what you get out the other end is probably a more rounded off square wave, but it still will have the exact same individual frequencies, if you know what I mean, before you get into the Doppler situation. So sending sound through water is a great way to go in many situations. And those whales will sometimes send some very low frequency notes, and they can talk to each other across hundreds of miles of water, and there's some speculation that occasionally they talk to each other at 1,000 miles of water. KC2 WGB, K2LIW in the TechNet.
KC2 WGB, crude answers there. Okay, that's about it from the mailbag for this week. And I want to remind you too, also last week you had mentioned about your basketball in the pond. I don't know if that's still applicable for today, but remind you of that. So, all right, good night. Back to you, Dick. KC2WGB.
Yeah, the basketball in the pond, if Glenn is available later on, I'm going to be hitting him with that one, because there's a whole series of basketball in the pond experiments that help explain what we see when we take a steady-state bar magnet sitting on the table, and you'd like to be able to detect its magnetic field. Let me pick a number, 1,000 feet away, which would be very difficult. But you take the exact same amount of magnetic field as your bar magnet, but make it an alternating magnetic field because it's part of an RF transmitting antenna, the exact same amount of magnetic field, but it's alternating. Not only can you detect it 1,000 feet away, you may detect it at 50 miles away, if you know what I mean. Detecting an alternating magnetic field has a huge advantage over steady state, and the basketball in the water partially explains that. I've come up with a Gedanken mental experiment, which I'm going to hit Glenn with later on, which may help that understanding, if I'm right. I got a bunch of speculations here. We'll find out. Paul, WS2N, I hear you've got a nice space report for us, and I've been told that NASA is thinking of launching another Curiosity Mars Science Observatory, and they're thinking by the year 2020 they're going to launch the next one. So you probably are going to be transmitting on the eastern input, and so give us a quick transmission. Let's see how...
Repeater, timeout. Repeat.
So let's see how well that works, Paul. WS2N, go ahead and make a transmission. K2LIW in the TechNet.
Thank you.